Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast, in which we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it is playing a key role in reshaping how business is undertaken in many parts of the world. My name is Andrew Murray-Watson. My guest today invests in emerging economies in support of the UN Sustainable Development Goals on behalf of grannies and grandpas in Amsterdam and across the Netherlands. Manfred Scheppers is founder and chief executive officer of ILX Management, the Amsterdam-based development finance asset manager. The company's first fund, ILX Fund 1, launched in January 2022 with a $750 million commitment from the Dutch pension provider APG, and funds under management now top $1 billion. From 2017 to 2021, Manfred was a member of the investment committee of the EU's European Fund for Strategic Investments. And from 2006 to 2016, he was Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development and led the bank's Institutional Investment Partnership Programme. Prior to that, he had an extensive career at SBC Warburg and UBS, where he was Global Head of Debt Capital Markets from 1990 to 2004. Manfred, good morning and welcome to the Impact Equals podcast.
Well, thank you, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be with you, albeit via the video from Amsterdam.
Firstly, can I just start by asking you about ILX and its work and its model? I mean, you invest on behalf of Dutch pension funds.
Yeah, we started, the origin of ILX is when I stopped my role at the EBRD in 2016. I was at the privilege of being the CFO and the vice president at the EBRD in London for 10 years from 06 to 16. And those years, of course, were incredibly impactful for all of us. A year after I started, the system sort of, we're staring at the abyss. EBRD is in Broadgate. We saw Lehman Brothers on the other side of the Broadgate, and all these things were very worrying. But of course, it was the beginning, literally, of a situation where we are today, where public finance effectively takes center stage. Of course, after financial crisis, it was in rescuing the banking system. But as we now, post the SDG articulation in 15 and the Paris Accord in 15. Again, we're seeing the public finance taking a center stage also in relation to sustainable finance and climate finance. And of course, we had the whole COVID crisis, which again saw the immense role of public finance in dealing with that crisis. So, yeah, I've had the privilege of learning from my 10 years at the EBRD at the effectiveness and the efficiency of a public finance institution such as the Multilateral Development Bank, as the EBRD is, and came back to the Netherlands and been working with the Dutch government and also with support from the UK government, from FCDO and the German government in determining that the strategy of co-financing with the development finance institutions such as the World Bank, EBRD, BII, to provide that as a strategy to invest on behalf of the pension funds generally. Yeah. But the first fund was funded by the main Dutch pension funds.
So set the scene for us. You arrived back in Amsterdam from London. What is the kind of the drivers for the founding of ILX?
I think the drivers were, interestingly, at that time, this is in 2017, I joined the investment committee of the European Commission, EFSI. That was providing a lot of sustainability, but also post-financial crisis financing across the European Union. At the same time, the SDGs had been sort of brought to life in Addis Ababa and the Paris Accord. And I had a wealth of knowledge from my CFO role at the EBRD at the effectiveness of the financing instruments of the development finance institutions, and in particular, the multilateral development banks, such as the EBRD and others, that are focused on investing in private sector projects across, in the EBD's case, transition economies in Central and Eastern Europe, North Africa, Central Asia. But the other multilateral development banks do that across Asia, Africa, Latin America. And from my experience as CFO, and working with my partner CFOs and CROs at the other multilateral development bank, I had a wealth of knowledge in understanding that what these banks do is really good investments because they're operating in an environment where the finance is provided for a project. So it's not just general, you know, finance in the way commercial banks do that. It was basically all very much project or use of proceeds, as we call it, related, and done under conditionality of the shareholders of these institutions. And who are these shareholders? Well, basically the European governments, UK government, US, Japan, and effectively are operating not at the lowest common denominator, but the highest common denominator in terms of investment policies. Well, what's the result? Good investments. And so I knew that. And of course, the business model historically had been to not share these assets. But after the SDGs and the climate accord in Paris, the world woke up that the challenges for sustainable development across emerging markets, the challenges of the energy transition, the challenges of nature transition, as we call it, this can't be done by the public finance entities alone. They need the private sector to join them. And so I thought, well, hold on, this is a marriage made in heaven, because I know these pension funds, in particular in the Netherlands, Scandinavia, but potentially also UK, they have the patience to be a long-term investor. You know, they have got the capital to be a significant investor, and they have the risk appetite to be able to invest in emerging markets. Only they want to know that it's safe to do so. They want to know that they're not going to lose money doing it. Yeah. And so we went on a project which we got funding for, as I said earlier, from the German government, the Dutch government, and the UK government to effectively do our case for investment of this asset class, and which now increasingly is being called the development finance asset class. And that, is it really investable? What are the returns? Until we did the research, nobody knew what the returns were for a pension fund investing in the strategy. It's only very recently, I mean, literally just before the spring meetings in Washington, that the underlying data that, when I was a CFO, we helped create the GEMS, this is the emerging market credit histories of the development banks, which was originally created by the IFC and the EIB. We were able to use that data to make the case for investment. That data last month during the spring meetings has now been made public. And it basically identifies the fact that the way development finance institutions like the multilateral development banks and institutions like the BII, the way they do their investment is extremely solid. You know, their loss rates are very low. And what we were able to demonstrate is that on top of the loss rate, the returns that these projects earn are also very much market consistent. Well, if you add up an asset class that has relatively low losses and attractive stable returns, well, you add up 1 + 1, it turns out that in fact it's very, very attractive. And that's now what's beginning to emerge, that this is completely an investable asset class. It's very scalable. And most importantly, it's directly focused and only focused on addressing the issues in relation to the sustainable development goals and the climate objectives.
So for you, obviously, with your experience, it's a bit of a no-brainer. But I imagine that in the initial conversations you had with pension funds, that the impression that the pension funds might have had might have been it's anything but a no-brainer. It's emerging markets. It's difficult. It's risky. What were those initial conversations like?
Well, prior to joining the EBRD, which was fortuitous to join them right before the financial crisis. Prior to that, I'd run debt capital markets at SBC Warburg, which became UBS. And from that time, I worked in banking in the 80s and 90s and to mid-2000s until joining the EBRD. It was very clear. And of course, our clientele in those days was these very pension funds. Yeah. And basically doing bond financing, structured credit, and you were placing these issues with pension funds, insurance companies, etc. But what I'd learned in those years that none of these investors via those media are making project-based sustainable investments. They're looking purely for tradable portfolios, returns against index. And the issue around sustainability use of proceeds was really not relevant. You're buying a prospectus, as long as there's liquidity, as long as the underwriter was a major investment bank. And that's the market today. Mm. What I also learned, and that's partially during my time at the EBRD after the financial crisis, of course, big players in emerging market finance up to the financial crisis were the big money center banks, the HSBCs, the Citibanks, Deutsche Bank, the big French banks. After the financial crisis, they've all basically disappeared from emerging markets. Mm. They have no exposure anymore. Now, even banks like HSBC, that was the major emerging market bank, effectively withdrawn. So you're seeing a situation where the capital markets are unable to serve the transition in emerging markets. They're unable to support sustainable development across emerging markets. And the international money center banks are unable to do so as well because their strategies are purely focused on domestic markets. I mean, just look at the Netherlands, look at the UK. It's without doubt that you're not going to be seeing the large Dutch banks go back into emerging markets. You're not going to see the Barclays, et cetera, go back to emerging markets. So, that's what I learned during my time, both in investment banking and at the EBRD, that if we are going to be investing and providing capital to the emerging markets, where the challenges in relation to the sustainable development goals and the challenges in relation to the climate finance, the energy transition, are the greatest, are far greater than they are in the UK or the Netherlands. These are rich countries. So it was obvious that this was an opportunity because I do see, that's my fundamental belief, that in the long run, economic growth, financial returns are going to become, are going to be attractive in emerging markets. Mm. We've seen it in the long run. You need to be patient. These are long-term investments, but emerging markets are in the long run going to try. But you've got to find instruments that are suitable for these pension funds. And these pension funds have suffered. I mean, you've seen the defaults in sovereign bonds in Zambia and Sri Lanka, Ghana, Argentina. I mean, these are bad experiences. There's been a lot of volatility in emerging market currencies. So the big investors haven't had a happy ride in emerging markets. And that's why I think the strategy of investing in emerging markets, but doing it via the lens of the multilateral development banks, doing it through the lens of a BII, is a very, very attractive and a very impactful way of still getting exposure to emerging markets, which I think it's negligent if large investors have no exposure in emerging markets in the long run.
So what sort of rate of returns do you promise your pension fund investors? I mean, I appreciate that it's much more than just about financial return, but presumably that is a kind of a prerequisite, right?
Well, I think now with the credit data that is now more public through what's called the Global Emerging Market Risk Database that has been published now by the multilateral development banks, and plus with the historical return loan data that I'll actually, the historical performance has shown that if you'd invested in development finance, generically, ignoring for the moment the role of ILX as a specialist, just doing the average, that already has outperformed on a gross basis the total return on emerging market bond indices or high yield bond indices. Plus the volatility in these bond markets, of course, is far worse. which is understandable because development finance is a private credit. It's not tradable. You know, it's a long-term investment that you make and you're an investor, similar to private equity, but then in the form of credit instead of equity risk. So its value, if the losses are very low and stable and the returns are stable over time, of course, the value of the asset is also stable over time. So you have a portfolio that is stable in value, returns are stable in time, whilst, of course, you've seen in these bond markets, they've been incredibly volatile in the COVID crisis, in the Ukraine war, during the financial crisis. So a lot of big institutions are very, they've been very frustrated by the high volatility they've seen in emerging market bond markets. And I think what we are seeing now is that maybe it's better to take an exposure via a conduit being the development finance institutions and generating returns that on a gross basis are higher. You know, leave aside net, which is the fee structures that are prevalent in the capital market. And of course, the fee structures in this asset class are lower.
Yeah.
So that's a bit the game changer. And of course, we're now already a few years old, but it's getting a lot of attention.
Mm. Global development finance is a very big arena, right? I mean, it encapsulates vastly different markets and vastly different investment strategies. How do you, within that context, ensure that the capital that you're providing goes where it makes the most impact? I mean, I guess I'm asking what the kind of the impact risk trade-off looks like.
Yeah. No, it's basically, thank you for the question, because it's basically our, what we call our USP, you know, unique selling proposition, is we only invest with the larger multilateral development banks or leading national development banks like BII. Now that's only we do not source our own project. We don't go on a hunting sourcing trip ourselves. We only, because that ensures that the reason for the project has gone through the filter, the safeguarding that these development finance institutions provides. To get funding from a IFC of the World Bank Group or an EBRD is really hard in relation to the safeguarding they do in terms of environmental standards, social standards, governance, anti-corruption. You know, these are very, very difficult institutions to business with. So, and we only invest in the projects that have gone through their process. Yeah? So that gives us a huge filter. Now, at the same time, it's still a very, very large market because we're working with the Asian Development Bank that does the whole of Asia, the Africa Development Bank, the whole of Africa, the Inter-American Development Bank, the whole of Inter-America, of Latin and Central America, the EBRD that operates in Central and Eastern Europe and North Africa and Central Asia, and then the national development banks like BII that has a unique franchise in Africa and in Asia. And the same applies to the national development banks in the Netherlands. We have FMO, but also in Germany, France. Mm. So it's a very, very highly reputable group of institutions. They're very keen to work on us because we basically are investing, pension money. We're not investing quick money. There is no speculation. It's very boring pension money that we represent, which is a very attractive co-financier for these development finance institutions.
Do you get to cherry pick which projects you co-invest on?
No, we have of course our own diversification limits.
Yeah.
One of the key drivers of our strategy is diversification. That's the attraction. So we don't get caught out in a Latin American crisis or an Asian crisis. Sure. Over the past decades, we've always got these regional crises. A Ukrainian war. The more you diversify, the more ultimately those regional concentrations don't matter. The same with sector concentrations. So we have our diversification across sector and across region. And we work with all these major institutions, and we only, of course, have so much to invest. So we're selective, but I wouldn't call it cherry picking.
No,
we are very predictable. We're of course very fast, so we don't have the bureaucracy of a big commercial bank behind us. And so, we operate as an asset manager. So for the MDBs and the DFIs, we're a very attractive partner. And on top of that, what is maybe important to explain to the listeners is we are not a commercial bank that's looking to cross-sell. We only make an investment for the pure sake of the investment itself. So we're not looking to provide a loan to a client because we might be also be able to do their M&A, or we might be able to do their payment services or some other service where we can make money out of. We only make an investment purely on the basis of what we think of that specific investment. That's it. Which allows us to make investments that are very impactful, are a bit off the beaten track. They would never be a client of a major bank.
Yeah.
But for example, we provide support to some of the largest banks in small countries. We've done the first industrial renewable project in Bangladesh and in Azerbaijan. These would never be clients of of Barclays or JP Morgan. But for us, they're very attractive projects from a return standpoint, from a risk standpoint. And that's our differentiator also towards the development finance institutions.
So how do you manage your risk? Because, I mean, obviously, there's a number of multilaterals and bilateral organizations, DFIs, that you can work with. And just using the example of BII, it's obviously that's the one I'm familiar with. We have a fairly low investment return hurdle, especially compared to sort of more commercial investors. And about 40%-ish of what we do is invested in the least developed countries. That's going to go up to 50%. And I imagine that other DFIs have different investment hurdles and different strategies in terms of where they invest. So is there sort of a leveling off point, if you like, that you take in terms of
this? I think what, in essence, if you want to look at the space within the financial system where the ILX strategy has the most additionality, it's in that double B space. It's quite interesting. If you hear, there's a lot of conversations, very traditional, I can only invest in investment grade. Nobody quite knows what it understands. They say, it's got a triple B label. Okay, fine. So somehow in the past, somebody has invented the word a triple B equaling investment grade and double B non-investment grade. You can't find it anywhere in terms of who owns the academia around investment grade, non-investment grade. But so we're effectively in a space where, for example, insurance companies find it very difficult to invest in below investment grade for their capitalization solvency reasons. A lot of retail investors, a lot of banks are very reluctant to sell non-investment grade investments to their retail investors. So you have to, so emerging markets generically is no longer a focus for the large international banks. So you're talking about a group of risk that has actually relatively constrained funding. It doesn't mean that they're the most needy, because a lot of them are countries like Colombia, Chile, Bangladesh, Ecuador, El Salvador, Brazil, Nigeria, Egypt, countries where, there are very good investment opportunities for ILX, but the focus of development finance institutions by their shareholders quite rightly saying, well, we want you to go to the more needy countries. We don't think you need to go to Egypt or to Kenya. Yeah, we think you should go to Mali or Rwanda. And so our additionality, in fact, is huge in that double B area. Yeah. Now, we also take single B risk. And so I think the ILX, what ILX offers to the multilateral development banks and development finance institutions to be able to mobilize, share more risk in countries which are not the highest risk in your eyes, so you can deploy more capital where the risk is higher, which from our investors could be a little bit too racy. For us, there's some countries, low-income countries that are triple C rated, which is precisely what the UK government and BII have as a focus, but for us would be a bit too exciting. But it allows, we still allow BII, for example, to do investments in upper or lower middle income countries, but share more of the risk with an investor like ILX.
Obviously, your funds under management are, I think I'm just right in saying, just over $1 billion. I mean, you briefly touched upon the scale of, I guess, the challenge and the opportunity of meeting the SDGs in emerging markets. How do you go about scaling your business and potentially other businesses like you from the billions to the trillions?
Well, I think we basically will go hand in glove with the multilateral development banks and development finance institutions. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're being asked by their shareholders to scale up significantly, both in relation to the SDGs and the overall climate objectives. And that's the World Bank discussion, the EBRD discussion. EBRD is going to go to sub-Saharan Africa. So everybody, it's very clear that the shareholders are expecting the MDBs and the DFIs to scale up their impact, scale up the number of projects, scale up the volume of the projects, because that's what's needed, the billions to trillions.
Yeah.
The private sector has to go and take part in that and share that. And for that, we have a clear vision that this very much suits pension systems that have an affinity for a private credit strategy alongside public bond strategies, that has an affinity with emerging markets, but most importantly, has a strong desire to align their portfolios with sustainability and climate. And that's, of course, a very much a growing group. Ten years ago, that was small, but nowadays, of course, the Netherlands has been at the forefront of it, and that's why we started in the Netherlands. But we're now creating our second fund as we speak. We're having Scandinavian investors join it. We did a seminar together with BII and ODI and FCDO 2 months ago in London for the UK pension funds. Mm. So I think if you add up the Dutch, the UK and the Scandinavian pension funds, even if you exclude the Norwegian oil fund, you're talking something in the region of $7-8 trillion. It's fast. Fast. I'm not saying that we're going to have a 1 trillion strategy, or at least not in my lifetime or whatever, but the potential is, of course, is vast, because if you look at how big conventional markets are, such as emerging market debt, such as high yield debt, if leverage finance, I mean, there is, the total, if you look at the total market of double B risk across all double B asset classes, such as high yield, emerging markets, leverage loans, structured finance, that market is trillions. Difficult to understand, to get full accurate data, but it's something, it could be close to 8 trillion in total if you include the US market. So having part of that risk move towards taking effectively this asset class, development finance, that data demonstrates that it generates very similar, if not better, returns, but with very clear sustainability and climate impact. I think the potential for the scaling up of the development banks, multilateral development banks, mm-hmm. and the national development banks to scale up that co-financing with funding from institutions that have the capacity to take that double B, single B risk, I think the potential is very significant, even from a relatively small group of countries with very large and well-funded pension systems.
Yeah, I mean, DFIs obviously take their capital from their respective governments, as well as, proceeds of investment. Do you see a fundamental change happening where actually the major pension funds start directly financing the DFIs, or at least co-investing as a norm alongside them?
Yeah, I think that is this gets a little bit technical, but I'll try and make it as intuitive as possible. Of course, public finance today does have a very intimate relationship with these investors, but it's done in the form of the bond issues. BII doesn't issue debt, but the World Bank issues bonds, the IFC, the EBRD, the African, Asian, they all issue AAA bonds, And the biggest buyers are the very pension funds we're talking to.
Yeah.
Also central banks and sovereign wealth funds. But in essence, these investors are also big investors, but in their AAA bonds. All that we're doing, and this is the technical part, all that we're doing is we're investing again in these institutions, but we're taking the project risk with them.
Mm.
Yeah. So if we do an investment with the IFC, the IFC remains the lender of record, and we invest in the project with them. But kind of, if you can visualize it, we're doing it through them. So with the IFC, it's called the B loan. It's not subordinated. It's in partnership with. So we're total partners with the IFC, but the IFC remains the lender of record. But we share the full risk of the underlying project. And therefore, the project is no longer on the balance sheet of the IFC. Yeah, so, and we use the same methodology of the development institution remaining the lender of record. We use the same technology with the Asian, African, Inter-American, EBRD, IFC, and also, you know, we've announced the partnership with BII at the World Bank annual meeting, also with the national development banks such as BII, FMO, DEG, Proparco.
Does the hypothetical involvement or the greater involvement of pension funds and the greater flow of capital into these types of projects, does that in a way, as a sort of byproduct, de-risk the proposition?
I think so. I think the more we get an alignment in finance where the purpose of finance is the underlying project.
Mm.
You know, the purpose of finance is not giving the management of the companies the mandate to do what they like, which, I mean, it's a bit of a cynical comment, but this is the way. You know, very much that's the heart of the City of London and Wall Street. You empower management with equity and debt finance to, you know, run a good company. And we give them a lot of freeway and leeway to do that. It's not a use of proceeds financing. What we're doing is use of proceeds financing. We in fact say, no, we really want to assure that the money is going to a place where we want it to go. And so if we're going to be seeing a significant scaling up of this form of finance, yes, the investors are going to have not a direct say, but they are going to have an influence on how development finance is done.
Mm.
Yeah, they're also going to have a voice. And so ironically, I see the ability for these pension funds to have engagement in projects far greater via this tool than via bond markets and equity markets, which is kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah. So what's lacking at this moment? What do we need to go from where we are now to reality where there is, you know, 10x or 100x or 1000x more pension fund capital going into impact investments in emerging markets? Is it just an imagination leap we need? I mean, what are the steps we need to take to get there?
Well, I think already now it's interesting, Andrew, that, you know, ILX, we're just 2 years old.
Mm.
We're managing now, yeah, of course, significant capital on behalf of Europe's largest pension fund, but still it's very new. And we're already beginning to notice that it has really had a significant impact in the way you see policy determination within the development banks. Huh? If you look at, you know, the joint work we've done with the MDBs, with BII. So from a development finance model, I think they all very much welcome these pension funds as partners. You know, they see them as very logical partners. They see them as being aligned in their return objectives. They see them as being aligned in their impact objectives, their patience, the quality of their stakeholders, and also the closeness of government. I don't think, you know, people are sometimes a bit concerned about that, but, you know, the fact that, you know, if you look at the UK, you know, the bulk of the UK pension system is very closely aligned with either central government or lower government. And the same applies to the Netherlands. I mean, our largest investor is investing money on behalf of all the civil servants in the Netherlands. The Danish investors who are going to be joining are similar. So there is a close link, not only in the way the governments are steering an institution like BII or an EBRD, they're also have a very close link with his pension system. So it is quite an interesting universe of stakeholders that are very much aligned in what they want to achieve.
There's a lovely symmetry, I think, in terms of pension funds investing essentially to make the world a better place for the generations to come. But Manfred, give us a bit of an exclusive. You referenced you're raising another fund. Where do you think it's going to close off at?
We have a target fund size of $2 billion.
Okay.
Now what is the main driver of it is what we see as a responsible scaling up.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we don't want to do is, which I think is a little bit sometimes the issue of a lot of the alternative asset managers, where they take in too much capital and then struggle to deploy. We want to ensure that we can remain that we can have the diversification in the portfolio we need and be selective. And the scaling up of the MDBs and the DFIs, it's happening, but you can't turbocharge BII in a heartbeat, and the same applies to the IFC and the EBRD. The EBRD is going to become active in sub-Saharan Africa. Well, that's not going to happen in 2025. So a lot of these scaling up of the MDB system, yes, it's going to happen, but these are a little bit juggernaut type institutions. They don't change overnight. So I think we need to pace our scaling up a little bit with the scaling up of the MDBs to ensure our diversification and our selectivity. So I think we're in a good place, because I think we have good interest now from our investors in the Netherlands, of course, our existing investors, the portfolio is now yielding in dollars 9.5%. Yeah, of course, for them, they're kind of happy with that. Now, part of it's due to the fact that there's been a very terrible war in Ukraine that has made interest rates go up. Yeah, so it's not entirely due to our own contribution, but it just shows you that this asset class is yielding more than enough for these major investors. So I think we're scaling up in the Netherlands, and now also in Scandinavia. We're in discussion with pension funds in the UK. There are similar pension systems in countries like Canada, Japan, Korea, Australia. But I think we need to not run too fast. It's very very much a wholesale market. This is not something. It's not for the general public. Oh, it is kind of for the general public, because they're all involved in pension funds.
But, indeed. Just lastly, and we ask all our guests to the Impact Equals podcast the same sort of final question. What are the sort of the three, if you had to sort of pick three kind of trends that are going to be dominating the kind of impact investment industry over the next couple of years, what would they be?
I think, already what we have seen is that impact investment and regular investment are going to become the same thing. A bit like saying, are there investments that don't have a financial return objectives and investments that do have a financial return objective? Well, no, every investment has a financial return objective. Otherwise, it's not an investment. Otherwise, it's a gift. So one is, I think it's going to become the same thing. Now, within it, people might have particular strong views, particularly in the world of philanthropy, where, there will always be philanthropic work. Some people like to have philanthropic work which is revolving, which means I don't need to aim a financial return. But if I'm going to, I'm a rich person, I want to make a 1 billion contribution to XYZ, keep on investing the 1 billion, just don't make sure it goes below 1 billion. But I don't call that impact investment. I think that's the way philanthropy has been for probably centuries.
Yeah.
So I think I'm looking at impact investing as a systemic role, and that is going to become that's going to merge with regular investment. Secondly, I think the role of exclusions is going to get more important, because that's the most blunt way of expressing your conviction. Of course, we all think sustainable investment, impact investment is important. But what do you think is the most urgent thing to do in the world of global finance? And then you can express strong views, our investor in the Netherlands has taken that view. They do no more upstream oil and gas out. whether or not you're bond, equity, private equity. And some are being a bit more nuanced about it by saying they still want to engage. But so I think impact investment is going to become a big part of it for large investors. It's going to be around exclusions, and not only in relation to carbon emission. It's also again related to human rights. We see that in the Netherlands a lot, where people just don't want to invest in governments where there's human rights violations. And that's of course, ironically, a lot of these topics are very much synonymous with the policies of a BII or of an EBRD. So that's why for the pension funds and for ILX, it's very attractive working with these institutions because we're basically aligned. If we're doing a project with BII, we're not going to have a discussion about whether or not we want to do this oil field or not.
Right.
That's not going to be the discussion. That's the second one. And the third one, which I think is something we take very seriously, I think is going to become very important, is the role of public finance. There's a big discussion the whole time. How can we, in the private financial system, the capital markets, how can we find impact? And that's where we've seen big issues around greenwashing, big issues about just lots of data mapping over equity portfolios. Whilst the big role and the big challenges we have in regards to sustainability, in regards to the energy transition, is effectively a project-based finance. And a lot of this is being done via public finance entities, whether or not it's in developing markets or developed markets. If you look at the European Union, the role of the EIB, if you're in the UK, you've got your development institutions that are being discussed and probably with a new government will come into being. But in the developing markets, it's a well-known group. Finding a way of working with these public finance entities, I think, is going to become a big part of impact investment. Not so much, not to fall in the trap of calling it, that must be blended finance. Let's do impact investment to BII, and BII takes all the risk and I get all the upside, and that sounds like a wonderful deal. No, that's nonsense. That's not where we're going to go. But finding modalities of working with a BII or an EBRD, I think this is also where there's tremendous growth. It's difficult. It's hard. But I think doing the easy route of just greenwashing bonds, I think, is not the long-term sustainable route.
Manfred, lastly, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation with you, hearing about the evolving role of pension funds in development finance. And I think for anyone, especially anyone sitting within a development finance institution today, listening to your comments, I think it's they'll be a real eye-opener and really encouraging in terms of what the future holds. So again, thank you so much. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. And until next time, goodbye.